is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and of course, some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our calls, what are our topics this time?
Well, we're going to talk about an alternative to the treadmill that has four legs.
Let me guess.
Alternative to the treadmill that has four legs. Okay. We'll keep you thinking. And then we're going to talk about a really serious issue. We're going to talk about suicide risk among gay teens, what the issue is, and maybe how we can change as a society to help really support our young teenagers who are at risk for suicide. Awful, awful, terrible.
Important topic. What's right. Our recipe?
Ginny's Spicy Tofu Cubes.
One of those words doesn't make this a favorite recipe for me. But Ginny says, I understand, that even I will like this recipe.
We'll see.
We will. 800-462-7413. Don't forget our medical myth buster coming up later in the hour. To the phones we go now, Zorba, and welcome a listener in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello there.
How can we help?
Well, I have this vertigo problem that started a couple of weeks ago. We were out camping. Mm-hmm. I got up in the middle of the night, and suddenly the room, or the trailer in this case, was spinning. And it didn't go away until the next day when I actually went and got some Dramamine with Meclizine, mm-hmm. which I had used before. But I'm still having the problem. I find that when I put my head back far and come up, as in swimming or drinking from the milk bottle, mm-hmm. that it's still with me, and it kind of comes back at night, too. And I just, you know, no one's really given me any definitive explanation for this. They just say, well, yeah, Meclizine is a good thing to take and move slowly.
Yeah, I can totally empathize with you. Throughout my life, I've had that kind of problem. I go through periods whenever I get my hair cut, and you put your head back to get to get it washed, and then you come back up. It's like, whoa. And
exactly.
Then in fact, after I finish with my haircut, getting out of the chair, I feel like I'm 100 years old because I'm sort of worried about falling down. I've had that pretty. Have you had this all your life, or is this new?
No, this is. Well, I had it about 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and suddenly, you know, out of nowhere, it came back again. So I just don't understand.
Yeah. Well, you don't need Zorba for this. I can help you with this.
Oh, okay.
This is this.
Wait a minute. How am I going to make a living if you give her the help?
This is dizziness, and it comes and goes, and there's nothing you can do about it.
No, that's not the case. It is absolutely not the case. You know, he's a therapeutic nihilist. That's what we call him in medicine. Doesn't make a difference what you do. It's not going to matter. We all go down here. We're going to die anyway. Don't do anything. Thank you. Click. Next call.
Well, I'm hoping that you can shed some light on this, because I'm in a quandary.
Well, it is. It's sort of a quandary, and it isn't. So what you most likely have, you can't tell without a diagnosis, but most likely you have benign positional vertigo. And it's only called benign. It's really not benign because it bothers you. But it's only called benign because it means it's not something that's going to kill you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a brain tumor. And mm-hmm. it's based on your position. And the present theory is this. We've got within our head, where we hear, we've got a little balance mechanism. And our balance mechanism has these little crystals that tell us when we're upright and when we're at our side. There are two things in the balance mechanism. One are these little canals, you know, that are called the semicircular canals. And then there are these little crystal things. And the theory is that the crystals get misplaced. In other words, they're in the wrong canal in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so the body is saying, hey, you're not really straight up. You're really on your side. And so you develop this what's called nystagmus, which you may have where the world is spinning,
yeah.
or you have that feeling, until everything equalizes. And for many people, that may take a few seconds. It might even take up to a minute. And Meclizine, Dramamine, antihistamines like Zyrtec, they're helpful to help some of the symptoms, mm-hmm. but they don't really address the problem itself.
Yeah. So what do you do to fix the problem?
Well, and you had
like
this
I said.
You had this done.
How do you align the crystal?
There's something called Laplace maneuver. It's A-P-P-L-E-Y-S, and I may be misspelling that. It may be A-P-L-E-Y-S. But if you go Google Apley's maneuver, and you'll find it on YouTube. There are a number of places that have done a number of physical therapy places. And what you basically do is you put your head back in a certain position, and over a period of about a minute to a minute and a half, you start rotating your head in a very specific way to sort of try to flip the crystals out of the wrong place. Mm-hmm. Excellent way to do it. Follow it exactly. It works. It tells you how to tell if you're supposed to go to the right or to the left. Mm-hmm. And good luck to you.
We can post that video on our website and Facebook.
We will. We'll put it on our website and Facebook. So you can come to ZorbaPastor.org. And if you go to ZorbaPastor.org, we'll have the Apley's maneuver that I find is good. And that'll be right on our website.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Sure. We appreciate the call. Thank you. We should put on the website my getting my hair washed and then sitting up and falling
off the chair. That's it. That's what will be on the website, too. Tom getting his hair washed, falling down, and breaking a leg.
So 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. To Bricktown, New Jersey we go now. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
I have extreme varicose veins. Doctor has diagnosed it. He said on a scale of 1 to 5 that I am a 5. I wear compression supports every day to work. The highest you can get are 30 to 40. I have horrible, horrible itching. I keep the Benadryl people and the hydrocortisone people in business, I think. I just use a lot of that stuff. And I was just wondering if there's a natural way that I can maybe try to get that itching down. It's I come home a lot of times from work. I still work full time, I just come home, and a lot of times I'm just really suffering bad with
it. Yeah, it sounds awful. How old are you, can I ask?
I'm 56.
Isn't that young, Zorba, for that kind of varicose vein problem?
No, not necessarily. Some people get get varicose veins when they're younger. A lot of women get it when they're pregnant, and that certainly is younger. And varicose veins we'll talk about where the itching comes in, are basically we have little valves in our veins, and the way blood gets back to our heart is by our muscle movements. So we walk, we use our muscles, and it's a one-way valve until a bus, and the blood goes up and then it stops, so it doesn't fill up the vein. And what happens is when the veins get busted, either by a trauma or genetics or pregnancy, the blood just stays in the vein. People can get symptoms. Usually the symptoms are fatigue and muscle aching. I question whether or not itching is the real issue, but clearly you've got varicose vein and itching, so let's attack that. Yeah. How long have you had this itching for?
I've had this situation probably started about 15 years ago. I work retail. I'm on my feet pretty much,
All the time. Do you wear support stockings at all?
That I do. So I wear compression supports. I wear the highest compression, which is 30 to 40.
Okay, so you wear compression stockings. And part of that is probably the compression stocking on the skin. That may be part of what the issue is. What kind of soap are you using when you wash yourself?
I don't use soap.
You don't use soap at all? Okay.
No, I don't because it just makes me very dry.
And it makes you very dry, makes things worse. So that's a very important issue. A lot of people use deodorant soap, Lifebuoy, Irish
Spring. I gave all that up.
Yeah, Dial. It's that stuff will make you itch completely.
Yeah, I found out the hard way that
one. I bet you did. Have you ever been on a higher dose, higher potency steroid cream for your legs? Prescription?
No, I mean, the biggest one you can buy over the counter is 1%.
That's right. Okay, I've got a couple of ideas for you. First of all, this is a skin-related issue, obviously, because it's itching. Maybe related to the varicose veins in that you have them covered with the support stocking, which you need to do. And the varicose veins themselves can give you some symptoms. But I've got a specific idea. First of all, you're doing the right thing by not using soap on your legs. Absolutely the great thing. During the daytime, it would be safe, I would take either Claritin or Zyrtec. A Zyrtec may be a little bit more powerful for you, and if you can tolerate Benadryl at bedtime, you're probably going to tolerate Zyrtec. And I would take a Zyrtec during the day, and I would take a Benadryl at night. That's number one. Number two, I would try over-the-counter Tylenol. Now, one of the reasons is an itch is actually the pain fiber gone awry. You could sort of think of it that way. And sometimes a little bit of Tylenol can actually help reduce the itching. So I would just try that. I do a little experiment. I take 325 milligrams, one tablet. Maybe I'd take two. The third thing I would do is call your doctor, and I would get a higher potency steroid cream, and I would wear that at nighttime, and I'd put it on every night. And the cheapest, most inexpensive, it's middle of the road potency cream that's a generic is called triamcinolone, TMC cream, capital T, capital M, capital C. That's the abbreviation cream. 0.1%, and I would put that on at bedtime when you don't have your support stockings, because that may be enough to reduce the inflammation in your leg along with the over-the-counter antihistamines in the morning to make a big difference.
Thank you so much. And, I just wanted to tell you guys, thank you from everyone. I mean, I don't know if people take the time to thank you, but I certainly do listen, and I really do appreciate everything that you do for folks.
Aren't thank you, nice? You so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, most of our listeners, couldn't care less.
No, they couldn't care less.
Unusual.
That's
man.
It.
I actually
that's right. You're unusual to get a compliment. Usually most of the people, when they're all done, say other things other than thank you.
800-462-7413. Want to talk with the doc? 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, to our first topic, and I think I guessed this one. I'm very, very clever.
Yeah, you
said
are
this
clever.
This is a four-legged alternative to treadmill.
That's right, four-legged alternative to the treadmill. And so we know it's not a fish.
Right. And it isn't even a cat.
It isn't even a cat. It is a...
dog.
That's right, Tom.
I'm so clever.
Yeah. That's right, Tom. And this was an article, very interesting article, that looked at people who have dogs. Yeah. Now, obviously, when you have dogs, you have to take your dog for a walk. Yeah. And it's a motivator. Your dog comes up to you and goes, woof, 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 or whatever your dog does, says, I want to go outside. And people go outside most of the time with their dog. And there was an article published by essentially research out of Michigan State University that looked at dog walkers who, people who take their dogs for regular walk. So we're not talking about living in New York City where you pay somebody to take your dog for a walk.
Right.
That doesn't count. It's right. Where you take your dog for a walk. And 60% of them, that's a whopping 60% of them met the federal criteria for either moderate or vigorous exercise. Mm-hmm. In other words, when you look at what we're supposed to be doing, which is roughly 30 minutes a day, you look at people who have dogs, and when they walk their dogs, they often walk their dogs for 20 to 30 minutes a day, and they walk them at a speed that's enough for them to meet the federal criteria of exercise.
Yeah, they don't have bassets, obviously.
Well, Wait a second. Some of these people have bassets.
No.
Some of these people have standard poodles like me.
You don't need any criteria that includes speed. If you
speed
have a
with
basset.
A basset. Yeah. Because bassets are not the high speed dog. They're not like a greyhound.
Bassets sniff and move a foot. Sniff and move a foot. Sniff and move a foot. There's no exercise. There's no speed. But other dogs.
Wait a second. But when you walk your basset, how long do you walk your basset for?
In the morning, about a half an hour.
Half an hour. Well, and how about so you walk your basset
about 20
more than
minutes
once a day.
In the middle of the day.
So you're doing an hour 20 with your basset.
No, about 45.
45 and 20.
Yeah, so but doing, it's not exercise is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you don't. Well, this particular study showed that the non-basset dog owners.
There you go.
The non-basset dog owners. And, of course, we know, of course, that probably the dog owners that get the most exercise are those who own greyhounds, right? Because they're always running after their greyhounds.
I don't think so. Greyhound owners tend not to have. Dogs don't run when they're in the city.
Yeah, that is true.
They walk.
They tend to be good.
Running. They've run most of their lives. Now they're retired.
Yeah, okay. They're just slow walking. Yeah. Well, getting back to the study and forgetting about the type of dog, it showed you that when it comes to exercise, the best exercise for you is that which you will do.
Yeah.
And so for some people, having a dog and walking the dog is not just good for the dog, because you come home and go, if you're a working person, you go, hey, I've got to take the dog for a walk. Or if you're retired, you go, I've got to take the dog for a walk. That dog may motivate you. And so I think it just reminds us of the motivational aspect of exercise that's often missing, so we miss our exercise. And, in America, that's the big thing. We're slugs, and the less sluggy we become, the healthier we will be.
Yeah, so get a dog.
Get a dog. It doesn't work with cats. I've tried to take a cat on a leash, and what happens when a cat's on a leash.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. Ann Zorba, a listener with us now in Seattle, Washington. Hi.
Hi, Tom.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question about leg pain that I experience typically when I am sitting in a car.
Are you driving or passing?
No. Let me describe a little bit more. It happens whether I'm driving or a passenger.
Mm-hmm.
And it typically will begin in my left leg. Well, it always begins in my left leg, but it begins after about maybe 10 minutes.
Hmm.
And then it starts on the other side as well. And this is always in the upper thigh.
Mm-hmm. How long has this gone on for?
I've noticed it off and on over about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be much worse in the last few months.
So 10 years, but getting worse.
Ten years
might get any worse. Different in different cars, you know, is the, you know, do the, I mean, you've had, I assume, more than one car in 10 years. Maybe you haven't, but do you notice it in different cars? You have more pain in some cars than others?
Well, it is a little bit different. Typically, I'm not riding in the same car because, actually, I don't have a car, so I don't drive. But when I'm a passenger in a car or sometimes driving a car, irrespective of the car, it happens.
Okay. It happens.
But it is worse in certain types of seats
and
than others.
Disappears when you get out of the car.
Yes.
Doesn't seem to bother you when you get out of the car.
You know what my wife does? Carry a seat cushion with her all the time. I wonder if it has something to do with your proximity from the floor to the seat.
Well, that's exactly what I'm thinking. What happens is sometimes we will, when we're sitting in a car, in an automobile, we can put pressure on the nerves that are in our sciatic area, either the sciatic nerve or other nerves. And different cushions affect different things. So some people actually have a sort of a wedge that they put underneath so that they're lifting their knees up slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And when they sit in the car, they find it's extremely comfortable. Some people actually have a full cushion of a front and a back. Some people just have a back with a cushion. It sounds to me like this is architectural. In other words, you're pushing on a muscle and a nerve and a ligament, but it's probably a nerve, and putting pressure on that. And, you know, that's actually what's happening. That's what I think. Try a bolster and see what happens.
Okay. Well, I would say I've actually tried a book. I tried that the last time I was riding in a mm-hmm. car, and that helped.
Oh, well, then, you know, that's a good example. And of course, it depends on the size of the book.
Yeah.
A little paperback book probably isn't going to do much, and I don't think the Kindle's going to do anything.
That's true.
Thanks so much for your call.
Okay, thanks, Sarva.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
800-462-7413, toll-free. And Zorba, before our short break, it's time for another edition of Disagreeing with a Doc. Today's disagreement deals with vitamin D. Not too long ago, we were chatting with a young woman who was prescribed 50,000 units of D per week. Well, you felt this was way too much and recommended she drop back to 2,000 units a day. Well, it didn't take our listeners long to flood our inbox with their dissent. We also heard from a fair share of your MD peers, including Dr. Emily from Billings, Montana. She writes, "In this part of the country, we treat vitamin D deficiency frequently. While taking 2,000 IU daily is generally effective, as you indicated, a treatment course of 50,000 IU weekly for 6 to 8 weeks before switching to 2,000 IU daily is an established treatment option for particularly low levels. Although there is not good evidence for it being superior treatment, it is not malpractice if the patient actually has low levels and is treated with this prescription dose on a temporary basis."
You know something? We had a number of letters on this, and I want to correct exactly what mm-hmm. I said. I mean, this is a good chance to actually go through and review the literature on vitamin D. And the letters that came in, they are exactly correct. So let's talk a little bit about vitamin D and set the level straight of what we need to do. First of all, vitamin D deficiency was a common problem back in the early part of the 1900s and prior to that with rickets, with children.
Right.
And in fact, until we put vitamin D in milk, which which was invented at the University of Wisconsin by Dr. Steenbach, we had lots of problems. Even in places like Denver, where they get quite a lot of sunshine, two-thirds of the children in the 1920s who were not drinking fortified milk had vitamin D deficiency. So we know that the rickets issue basically has been satisfied by vitamin D fortification of foods.
Well, we've talked about all that, and we've talked about 2,000 being, how do you go from that
to 50,000? Well, the issue is when you have severe vitamin deficiency, and you can get a vitamin D level at your doctor. It's becoming more and more common, and people who have significant vitamin D deficiency do have a number of problems. They can have bone pain. They can have what's called proximal muscle pain. They can also have some subtle changes, which are even cognitive changes. We know the chronic pain is not from vitamin D deficiency, but we know that people with severe vitamin D deficiency can have muscular pain. She from Billings, Montana, the physician who
wrote,
Dr. Emily is exactly correct. The standard treatment is to give 50,000 units weekly until the vitamin D level is up to a certain number. Generally, it's above 30, which is the measurement in a particular lab. And at that point, you may go down to 2 to 4,000 units a day. So in other words, it's kind of bringing up the storehouse. And I was wrong in the fact that I was really going to the immediate chronic maintenance therapy when, in fact, you're far better using this large dosing of 50,000 units a day until you get to the maintenance aspect. So that is exactly the case. And for some, the prescribed therapy is, once again, 50,000 units. And this is usually given on a weekly. It's a weekly dose. And then they go on to the maintenance dose after that.
Interesting. Yeah. If you disagree with Zorba, let us know during our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And I want to thank all of my medical and professional colleagues for chiming in.
We're going to, in a little while, thank Crossville, Tennessee listener Jenny for a really good recipe, even though it has tofu. That's coming up. More of your calls, too. Our medical myth buster. And another interesting topic, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but a line open for you at 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, it is recipe time. And for this week's recipe, I am happy to welcome Crossville, Tennessee listener Jenny Wiedemann. Jenny, hi.
Hi, Tom.
Tell us about Jenny's spicy tofu cubes. Hard for me to say tofu without kind of getting a little gag. How did you come up with this one?
Well, actually, I found the recipe someplace, and I've had it for quite a while, but I've used it for a long time, and it's absolutely delicious. And, of course, I sent this in just for you, Tom.
Well, so you say, in spite of the tofu, you think I'm going to like this recipe.
The beauty of tofu is that it basically doesn't have any taste.
Right.
And you can turn it into whatever you want to. And this stuff is really, really delicious.
Mm-hmm. So you like this a lot. What do you use it as a snack? Is that what you do? Or where do you use this?
I believe, if I remember way at the back of my brain, it was presented originally as an appetizer, which it can be. I made a batch one day, and my husband was sitting in the kitchen. And I said, You want to try one of these? And he said, sure. And we ate the whole batch.
You ate the whole batch.
Yeah, we ate the
whole batch. In other words, you and your husband had tofu snacks.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Tom right now, and his mouth is watering. It's just, the concept
of it. I'll be honest with you. I took a little sneak peek at the ingredients, and I think I actually might like this.
Oh, know. So we have found you may have developed a tofu recipe.
Yeah.
So we no longer can call him anti-tofu Tom that he might actually try.
Let's put it together and see what listeners think.
So let's do that.
Okay. Oh, you can also use these as croutons for a salad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
With a nice big bowl of romaine lettuce.
Mm.
Now, they're not going to be crunchy like bread croutons.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to keep that in mind, but they are delicious.
Yeah.
And I very often, we love pumpkin soup and butternut squash soup, and I will use them in as croutons in the soup also.
I love that as a concept. And pumpkin soup is one of my favorite, one of my favorite soups.
And you can also toss them in a stir fry in place of meat or whatever.
It sounds fabulous.
They're very versatile.
So, Ginny's Spicy Tofu Cubes. So, we start out with 3 tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil, 1 teaspoon of powdered. You use powdered ginger or do you use ginger that you grate?
No, in this recipe, you have to have the powdered ginger.
Powdered ginger. Okay. Uh-huh. Powdered ginger. 1 teaspoon of powdered ginger. 1 teaspoon of powdered turmeric. 1 teaspoon of powdered turmeric, and 1 teaspoon of garlic powder. So a teaspoon of ginger, turmeric, and garlic powder. Sounds tasty. And then 8 ounces of extra firm organic tofu drained and cut into 3/4 inch cubes. How do you drain it? You just put it in a colander? What do you do?
Okay, well, what you do is you take a block, a 1 pound block of organic tofu.
Gotcha.
Then you take a couple of good-sized paper towels, fold them until they're just slightly larger than your cube of tofu.
Mm-hmm.
Put them on a plate, put the tofu on top, fold another paper towel or two, put that on top, put another plate on top, and then fill a jar with about 8 ounces of water and set that right in the middle. The tofu is saturated with water, and you need to get as much of the water out of there as possible so that it will absorb all the really good juices that you're going to be putting into it later on.
Makes sense. And I know just what you mean. Any of us who have worked with tofu, and of course Tom is a tofu chef.
Right.
I mean, he hides behind the anti-tofu screen, but when you take back the curtain, this is what he eats all the time. And that's, of course, it. You take out the tofu, the water is on the outside, but the water is permeated on the inside too. And what you're basically doing is wrapping it in a paper towel and putting a weight on top of it so the water can come out of that.
We haven't even come to really interesting ingredients.
Yes. Yeah. 1/4 cup of wheat-free tamari. So you buy this at a health food store, Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, something like
yes.
that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I use Sanjay brand, S-A-N-J.
Right. Oh, yeah. And under the brand of tamari, soy sauce can make a big difference. La Choy, which I never, ever buy, which is a very common brand. You're laughing. You know what
I
mean.
It's insulting. Actually.
Oh, it's terrible. It's insulting to the concept of soy sauce. It's sort of like salt with a little soy taste. It's just
right.
a terrible, terrible tasting soy sauce. And, you find it in every grocery store, every big grocery store in America. You want to buy a good tamari-type soy sauce. And there are a variety out of there that are very good. And wheat-free is okay for people who want that. But there are a variety of good soy sauce. Do not think of all soy sauce as the same. It's not. Find a soy sauce you like the taste of and use it. 1/4 cup. Okay. 2 tablespoons.
By the way, this recipe segment is sponsored by La Choy. Putting La Choy in soy sauce.
Bring La Choy into your life. I'm sure we're going to get some La Choy lovers who will flood our e-box. Thank you, people. 2 tablespoons of freshly squeezed lemon juice. And as you know, the freshly squeezed, there's no comparison. I will use the frozen if I don't have the fresh around the house, but I don't use the reconstituted in the jar because it doesn't work as well. Tablespoonful of maple syrup. Pretty
lemon juice, maple syrup.
Right. And then a dash of cayenne or hot paprika.
And pepper.
Optional. You like that. So you like to have
lemon
it nice
juice,
and hot.
Maple syrup.
Yeah,
pepper. That sounds
very
really interesting.
Interesting. It's got
to me.
Some sweet.
Yeah,
it's got
yeah.
the sour of lemon juice, and it's got hot. I like it as a concept. So let's make it in a large you know, pan that you're going to use to sauté. Sauté the oil and spices over medium heat. Then add the tofu cubes that have been drained and basically drained and drained and drained and the water taken out of it. Gently toss them, coat them over, and then combine the tamari, lemon juice, maple syrup, and hot pepper if you're going to use them to the pan. Continue turning the cubes, coating them very evenly, and cook until the liquid is absorbed and the cubes are crunchy. Crunchy tofu. Very interesting concept. Remove the cubes, put them on paper towels to drain and enjoy. I think we are going to get a ton of people who are going to want this recipe. I just love this as a concept.
I think the next time I cook, I'm going to do this.
Do it.
That is not a good sign because we know that Tom cooks once a decade. If I say the next time I cook, it's going to be soon. And yeah. If Tom says the next time he cooks, forget it. It's not going to happen.
It sounds really good. Thanks, Jenny, so much.
Thank you for having me on.
You bet. And for sending us this winning recipe, Jenny gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org. And while you're at that, why don't you go to our website at ZorbaPastor.org. You can sign up for our podcast or be a fan on our Facebook page. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, here's a listener in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
How can we help?
Well, I'm a truck driver, okay, and I recently started dieting and exercising, and I quit drinking soda, got rid of just about all the caffeine. Unfortunately, the problem that I run into sometimes is I need that little jolt that caffeine used to give me, you know, to kind of wake me up throughout the day. And I really want to stay away from the caffeine and the soda, and I was hoping that maybe you might have some suggestions as far as maybe some foods that would naturally do it for me, or maybe some sort of vitamin supplement, something like that.
Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of suggestions. First of all, I want to give you the history of caffeine, which is rather interesting in a nutshell. The Dutch introduced coffee into New York City, which was New Amsterdam, and they found it was very efficient. It kept people on task. They could do their tasks in the morning. The Puritans, who were there before that, their morning drink of the day was a glass of rum. So you can picture the difference. The Dutch had coffee in the morning, and the Puritans had a glass of rum in the morning.
I think my company would down on the rum.
I think so, too. They really wouldn't look forward to it. So the issue with caffeine is that caffeine is a safe drug to use. It's the most common drug that's used throughout the world because it keeps people on task.
You're going to have a hard time finding something negative about coffee from Zorba.
Yeah, that's right, because I'm kind of a caffeine and a coffee person. But I do have some recommendations that might actually help you. And that would be green tea. A green tea does not have the caffeine of coffee. It has antioxidants. It has certain other properties that seem to be very, very good for your health. And it's also used throughout another part of the world, throughout Asia, to actually wake people up. And there's also something about the heat of the beverage that's also important. So my recommendation is, at around 9:30 or 10 o'clock, whether you're in your rig or not, that you get some hot water. You can pre-make the green tea and put it in your thermos. And that's what I would do as a coffee substitute. I think green tea is excellent. It's used throughout the world, and it's the heat that's also part of it. I don't think that green tea drinks have the same thing going for them as some hot green tea, and that's what I would use.
What about a piece or two of dark chocolate? Would that
dark chocolate may have that. That might be useful for you. That's right, because dark chocolate itself is called a xanthine, and it's similar in properties to chocolate. But I don't know if there's any evidence that dark chocolate would wake you up, but you might try that. A piece of dark chocolate would be good. But I think the green tea and the heat is sort of the way to go. That's really commonly why people often, have a lunchtime jolt.
And if you're doing the green tea, you do need the thermos. Those truck stops, it's kind of hard to get green
You won't tea. Find good green tea. And, look at different kinds of good. I would look for a good organic green tea. I mean, that's what I would do. I would try a green tea that you like. And frankly, what I would probably do if I were going to try it is I would do it in a thermos and I'd brew it at home. Because if you just leave the tea bag in there too long, it becomes bitter. And some people like that bitter taste, but I think a more robust taste is not to have that. So,
Okay. I will give that a try.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Zorba. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. We're going to hear from the truck stop people now. We have the best green tea.
You think so?
Yeah.
I wonder. They may have the best mashed potatoes, but I don't know if green tea is at the top of their list.
Well, before we get to our break, Zorba, let's take this quick note from the Zorba Pasture and Your Health inbox from Bob in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Bob heard us riffing with a caller about an old home remedy for warts using pennies. Now, while Bob can't speak to the efficacy of the wart treatment, we do owe him a penny for his thoughts on another issue. You recently had someone suggest putting a penny on a wart as a treatment, and you mentioned lead pennies in your response. Although some people did call them lead pennies, there was no lead in them. They were made out of zinc coated steel in 1943 due to the high demand for copper for the war effort. They were also called steel or silver pennies.
Well, he's right. But in Chicago, we called them lead pennies. So, you know what? It's all the vernacular. I never heard the term steel pennies. I knew they weren't made of lead because I remember as a child, I actually remember chewing on lead soldiers when I was a kid. It kind of tasted good. But anyway,
That's
not recommended in this day and age. But lead itself, of course, was too soft. And yes, you are correct. They were made out of zinc and they might have been called steel pennies, but in Chicago, hey, we call them lead pennies, and I've got 200 of them in my house. So if you want one, write me a letter.
You have 200 of them?
Yes, I do.
Why?
I have no idea. My dad had a can of lead pennies. I think he thought they were worth a lot. Can I tell you something? Each penny on the market today, I think it's worth a nickel or a dime.
Well, Bob adds, enjoy your show. Thanks, Bob. We enjoy hearing your two lead-free cents on any topic. Just send your questions, comments, and tips to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. We have another really interesting topic to talk about, some more of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster right here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 800-462-7413. But before our next call, some interesting info, I think, Zorba, on gay, lesbian, and bi teens and the suicide rate.
Right. And these are big issues. I think one of the issues that we have in terms of making our society safer for young people is reducing the risk of suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always an issue. The risk of suicide among teenagers is significant. And the question is, a lot of teenagers who attempt to commit suicide succeed because they, really make the attempt. And suicidal thoughts are not uncommon at all among teens, but suicide, unfortunately, is the common, final common pathway.
And gay teens, five times more likely.
Five times. This particular study said that they were five times more likely to commit suicide. And it appeared that there was a significant correlation with the lack of social support. In other words, so here it is, you're a gay teen or you're a bisexual teen or you're a lesbian teen and you're in school and the school has no club for you to join or has no alliance for you to join to be able to talk to other kids and be with other kids and be able to, express that. And a lot of times there's a lot of fear around that, And when I look at healthcare, I think it's important to look at healthcare. It's not a liberal thing. It's not a conservative thing. We all want good healthcare,
sure.
And we all want our children to be safe. And so the real question is, what do we do about it as a society? And there are a lot of issues that we have to address here.
Yeah, but now I'm guessing it may still be a little bit difficult for these clubs to be able to be formed in schools.
In certain areas, sure. You know, there's some areas that are going to be much more open, you know, where you might have gay and lesbian couples, you know, that actually have gay and lesbian teens. And, you know, some communities are more conservative and some communities are more open. So I think some of the issues here are as a parent or a friend or an aunt or an uncle, if there's a gay teen that you know of, I think talking to them about it can be useful. Saying, do you have, you know, what is your social situation? With teenagers, you don't use the word social, you know, but where are your friends? You know, talking to them, you know, have they talked to a school counselor or someone else? I think that's a very important issue. I think bringing it out and discussing it, but I think it's also discussing it with the school. What is the environment like in school? Is it an egregious anti-environment that makes it more difficult for our teenagers to, you know, to flourish? I think that's a very important issue.
Yeah, there's I think also a great vital campaign called the It Gets Better Project that can support teens.
Right, and so going online and seeing where the It Gets Better Project to be able to give that support within the school. Those are other issues that are there, and I think it's important. It's engaging the teen in a conversation, engaging the school in a conversation, engaging the parent in a conversation is going to make it more likely that we as a society can solve this problem.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Here's a listener now, Zorba, in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, this is Campbell in Jacksonville. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I am a new canner. I have just started making jams, and this past fall I got a recipe for roasted pickled beets, which I made and intended to eat right away, and the recipe didn't call for sterilizing the jars. So I didn't, but then we went out of town, we didn't get to eat it, and I still have them, but I'm a little bit nervous about eating them because I didn't sterilize the jars. I think they're probably okay because it's pickles, you know, and I know that that's not a sterile environment, but I just wanted, before I eat it, and I wanted to check and make sure so that I don't poison myself.
Well, by the way, you are always right to check and make sure about food safety when you're doing food safety at home. And the reason is there are different foods that you do that you essentially pickle in different ways. And it's not that pickling automatically gets rid of all of the bacteria, aerobic, that use oxygen, or anaerobic. Quite the contrary, you have to follow guidelines to make sure that each vegetable is basically put up. And that's what the term that we use in Wisconsin, you know, in the right way. And it's quite interesting because freezing was a very simple way to do things. You don't have to pay attention. You take it out of the freezer and it may taste good or may taste bad, but it's not the same as pickling. I've got a few suggestions. First of all, the Ball Jar Company, Ball Jar are those glass jars, has a wonderful, wonderful website. We'll do a connection on our website, zorbapastor.org, to both the Ball Jar website and it's either the FDA or the CDC website on safe canning and pickling. So we'll do that. We'll put that on the website. And I don't know the specifics for beets, you know, so because I know, for instance, that green beans are completely different from dill pickles, and dill pickles are different from tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And they're all different, and you have to pay attention to each and every one of them, and they have to be put up, I always recommend, in exactly the prescribed way, because that way leads to food safety. And you are 100% correct to make sure. Now, it's not necessarily that all jars have to be sterilized. They certainly have to be cleaned. But sterilization is always, you know, is always a safer way. And that's what I would do. So we'll give you the connector. And if I give you the answer to beets without looking it up, I would know it might not be right. And I think the important part of it when you're putting up any fruits or vegetables or anything is to always look it up, because then you've got it at a reliable source. Mm-hmm. You want to get from a reliable source and make it safe. So I commend you for doing that, and I commend you for checking it first, and we'll give you that link on our website.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
We appreciate the call. Are there any other kind of jars than the Ball jars?
Well, the Ball jar is just the most common jar. Oh, yeah. Kerr, I think K-E-R-R, is another company that makes jars. And, I mean, those are the two that I would use. Yeah. I used Kerr.
I've only heard of the one. I thought maybe they had
Kerr,
a monopoly.
Kerr and Ball jars. Well, years ago when you used to pickle.
Mason.
You used to put out Mason.
Yeah, that's right.
See?
Yeah.
You just thought of Mason. So now have Kerr jar and Mason. And I bet we will get emails from other companies that make other jars. But I used to be into tomatoes all the time. And I would would put up the tomatoes the right way. It would be in the middle of August. I had a huge tomato garden at one time with 20 plants. I had bushels and bushels of tomato. For about 5 years, I put up 50 quarts of tomatoes. And then I still remember the last year when it was the middle of the wintertime, and I thought, I have to use up all these tomatoes. And all of a sudden, I had just overdone it. And so I haven't put up tomatoes for a while, but they were always good, and it's always good to give away that homemade stuff. So
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, time once again now for our medical myth buster. As spring continues on, one thing blooming for some of our listeners isn't a cause to celebrate: allergies. Seasonal allergies can definitely be depressing, but new studies show they may lead to depression. Is this true?
Well, this is an interesting question. I don't think we can say that allergies lead to depression. I mean, I don't think there's any really good evidence of that. Now, there is evidence that allergy sufferers often suffer from depression, and they often suffer from depression during the times that their allergies bother them, especially if they don't treat them. They have sleepiness, they have headaches, they have fatigue, they have a general feeling of physical depletion. And I think if you're prone to depression, there's something called dysthymia, which is sort of pre-depression, where the world is kind of blue. Allergies can worsen your mood. It may throw you over, just like a physical malady of any sort.
Sure.
And throw you over. But I think you've got to have the depression to begin with. I don't think allergies in themselves, I don't think there's any proof that allergies in themselves cause depression. They just may worsen it if you're prone.
Just like any other bad thing that can happen to you, or relatives or friends, illnesses, dying, all that
absolutely
can bring on
absolutely.
A depression.
That's right. So I think if you're prone, yes, it's there, but I don't think there's any good evidence. I think it's a myth to say allergies cause depression.
Have a myth giving you the blues? Just send it to the show and have us bust it. Just send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
Well, I'm a 49-year-old female in good health, except I've been officially diagnosed with degenerative disc disease. Mm. It causes me quite a bit of pain. I have two questions. One is there any way I can slow this down? And the second question is, I love to hike. I live near Yellowstone. I hike certainly 5-mile hikes. I'd rather do 8 to 10 so I could go see some new stuff. But to do that, I have to take 8 milligrams of something like Tylenol or ibuprofen, all day long to accomplish something like that. And I don't know if that's good for me, or just because I can't feel the lower back pain because it's masked by the medication, am I hurting myself further, or is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Well, these are great questions. Let's look at Tylenol, first of all, which really is an excellent pain reliever. The guidelines basically are for people who drink 2 or fewer drinks a day, that you can take up to 4,000 milligrams a day. And if you're taking 8,000 milligrams a day, you said 8 milligrams, but 8,000 milligrams a day, that's a lot of Tylenol. So basically that's, they come in 325s and they come in 500 milligrams. If you don't have more than 2 drinks a day, you're okay at 4,000 milligrams a day. Your liver won't fall out. That's what people always say to me. I don't want my liver to fall out. And I thought, I've never seen a liver fall out of anyone, but we know that's an issue. And if you're a drinker, it's 2,000 milligrams a day. Those are kind of the guidelines. And the feds have looked at this. That's quite safe. Anti-inflammatories, also excellent. They're different than Tylenol. They really are not a liver issue. They are an issue more with the kidneys. I like Aleve better than ibuprofen. And the only reason is it lasts for 12 hours. Ibuprofen lasts for 8 hours, so it's just easier to take. And 2 Aleve tablets twice a day, that's double the dose on the bottle, works for many, many people. Now, I have people who have been on these for arthritis for years. They've been on either Tylenol, which is the ARA, American Rheumatological Association, first drug of choice for osteoarthritis. And I have people who have been on this for 20 years and have not had bad side effects. They're fine. And the same is true of anti-inflammatories. Some people can't tolerate them because they have a GI distress or a GI bleed, and they have other medical issues. But a lot of people do tolerate them. So I'm a great believer in these drugs because they keep you functional. They keep you functional. So if you find that you can take, 4,000 milligrams of Tylenol and you can hike those 8 miles in there, go for it. That's what I would absolutely do. Now, it doesn't slow down the course of your degenerative arthritis. There's no proof that we have anything that slows down the course of degenerative arthritis. But we do have proof that people who stay healthy, who do things, who walk, who do exercise, are more functional. We have great proof for that. So moving around is critically important, but your disease may burn out, may not go any further. Sometimes it burns out or it might progress, and I don't have that crystal ball.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. And before we leave for the week, Zorba, let's play another round of your favorite game, Stump the Doc. Our contestant today is Phyllis, who's stymied by a case of what she calls phantom smell. She writes, "Would you please discuss phantom smell? I've been dealing with this for about 2 years. At first, I thought it was an environmental thing, but later realized that it could happen anytime, any place. It's not an offensive smell, but it is most annoying. And I can't even discuss it with anyone because they would think I'd taken leave of my senses or perhaps have an overactive imagination, neither of which happens to be the case."
I have no treatment for phantom smell. Not at all. Not at all. The things are that you want to look at is they're almost like hallucinations. That's what they are. They're things that actually don't exist that you have the perception of that they're actually there. I've heard about it. I've read about it. You're not going off your rocker by having it. I don't know any treatment of it at all. You said it's not offensive, so that's just the way life is. And I have to tell you something interesting. Whenever I have had surgery, and I've had a few surgeries in my life, post-surgery, I hear phantom sounds.
Huh.
And I hear an occasional dog barking or a bell or a telephone that actually isn't there. And I don't talk about it to other people because I, too, am afraid that they'll think I'm wacko. So I'm very careful with that.
Yeah. So. Well, I think maybe now some other people may know about it.
Yes, some other people do know about it. So I can't. I guess I have explained it. So.
Think you can stump Public Radio's favorite family doc? Well, then send your questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich. Very special thanks to technical guru Tom Blaine for performing his stellar Brad Kohlberg impersonation today. Our theme music is by Leland Van Sidlin. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0430Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.